3 miles below this formation of American flying fortresses, there lies Marienburg in East Prussia. Up to this moment, one of the most important cogs in Germany's war machine. The specific target on which this lead bombardier is lining up his bombsight is the Fokker Wolf 190 plant. Up to this instant, this aircraft factory has been accounting for almost 50% of Germany's total FW-190 fighter assembly.
Bombs away.
Tons of bombs rain down in a tight pattern of destruction. This, remember, is no area attack. It is an assault on one single target, and any bomb that falls outside that target has failed to achieve its purpose. The assembly of fighters in this Fokker Wolf factory has come to a sudden and violent end. To many, the bombing of Germany probably seems to be little more than a series of capricious
The Führer and the Opel Blitz were inseparable comrades. Hitler and his soldiers needed it for the advance and later for the retreat. Hitler inspired Opel. What that meant was clear. Achievement, order, loyalty. As early as the 1930s, Opel, the subsidiary of the American company General Motors, begins to build military trucks. For the time being, however, in 1935, Hitler is not talking of war. He wants the Volkswagen, the people's car. The exhibition was dominated by the Führer's demand, create the German Volkswagen. Opel believes it already has it, the P4, the cheapest small car of its time. The company tries to get the government contract, but fails. Hitler wants a vehicle that can also be used for military purposes, that the people can use for their excursions into the expanses of Europe by paying 5 marks a month. The bucket car becomes the most popular VW model. Nevertheless, Opel is allowed to construct its Volkswagen, the Blitz. In 1935, after negotiations with the Wehrmacht, it builds the truck factory in Brandenburg. The Opel management, which at that time also included the Americans, is quick to recognize the lucrative business prospects offered by military contracts. Built for the new American production methods, the plant is the most modern in Europe. Every day, 120 trucks leave the conveyor belt.
Es war also dieser Opel Blitz das Rückgrat der Wehrmacht.
So it was this Opel Blitz, the backbone of the Wehrmacht, produced by Opel, and this is quite clear, with American money.
Amerikanische Gelder gebaut.
Without the Blitz, Hitler would not even have got as far as Vienna. When the Germans advanced to Austria, numerous vehicles from other companies break down. Overnight, hundreds of Opel Blitzes are requisitioned in Bavaria near the border so that the Wehrmacht can march into the Austrian capital. Hitler is grateful. He visits the factory in Brandenburg and orders a further 2,000 Opel Blitzes. In the 30s and at the beginning of the war, one American is particularly active in taking care of GM property in Germany, James D. Mooney, vice president of the company. In 1938, for his services in furthering Opel's development as a leading ordnance factory, Hitler awards him the Order of the German Eagle, the party's highest distinction for foreigners. Wherever it is deployed, the Opel Blitz passes all tests with flying colors. In the conquests in the east, in the annexation of the Sudetenland, and in the invasion of Czechoslovakia, and also in the Blitz campaigns in the west. Within a few weeks, in 1940, Holland, Belgium, and France are defeated. When the war begins, the production of private cars in Rüsselsheim virtually grinds to a halt. The machines lie idle, the number of workers diminishes as they are called up to serve in the Wehrmacht. The factory wants to stop this development, and the Luftwaffe also has a new use for Rüsselsheim. Opel now produces basic assembly parts and engines for the Ju-88, Hitler's most important bombers.
Grundsätzlich war schon wenige Tage nach Kriegsbeginn.
Basically, only a few days after the outbreak of war, close cooperation had been organized between the Luftwaffe, and the factory in Rüsselsheim. This had been also supported by a visit from Vice President Mooney, who was not only corresponding with the Nazi leaders, but was also present at the time in Berlin. He came to Rüsselsheim and also then met Göring.
Mit der NS-Führung, sondern zu der Zeit auch in Berlin anwesend war, hier nach Rüsselsheim gekommen ist und schließlich mit Göring auch zusammengetroffen ist.
In his talk with Göring, Mooney expresses a certain understanding for the policies of the Nazis. He also believes that after the First World War, Germany had been treated too harshly by France and England. Göring encourages Mooney to mediate between the belligerents. Mooney approaches President Roosevelt, and the latter agrees to be prepared to act as a moderator. Roosevelt wishes Mooney good luck for his mission. Berlin, February 1940. With a flattering letter to the dear Reich Chancellor, Mooney gains access to Hitler in his new Reich Chancellery. In a diary which was never published due to objections by GM, he records his talk with Hitler. In his report to Roosevelt, he describes Hitler as warm and friendly. However, Roosevelt is unimpressed by the Führer's megalomaniac demand that Nazi Germany be recognized as a world power. Mooney has played out his role as a useful idiot. After this, Messerschmitt, the Under Secretary of State in the State Department, calls Mooney a fascist. The strange episode concerning the Nazi friend Mooney had no influence on the course of history. Opel continued to build military vehicles, over 100,000 in the war years, urgently needed due to the high losses. In 1941, General von Schell, Hitler's director of mechanization, confirmed that without this company, war could never have been waged. Meanwhile, the Battle of Britain had been lost. Nor was Opel able to produce the Ju-88s at the speed with which they plummeted from the skies. This has a positive effect on the profits. In the party and in the ministries, this arouses envy and resentment. In 1941, GM refuses an offer to sell Opel and to withdraw from Germany. In a letter to the Reich Commissioner for Enemy Properties, GM reports that it has just begun to identify with Germany's fate. Behind this, however, is a financial consideration. GM had just claimed a tax deduction in the USA for its property in Germany and had thus earned $22 million. If the Reich had compensated GM, it would have had to pay tax for this.
During the first 2 years of the Second World War, the American management remained in place until around the middle of 1941, where they started getting very nervous and getting Americans out. So the executive boards of these American companies were still run by Americans. It was American CEOs who were going to the German Rüstungskommando and figuring out what quota of trucks are we supposed to provide, how many forced laborers do we need, how are you going to get us the labor and the materiel, where do we fit in your overall production scheme. They saw that their customer had certain needs, and they set out to meet those needs as efficiently as possible.
Meanwhile, GM is earning huge profits on American armaments, which are now being organized by Mooney. As a high-ranking reserve officer, he sees himself as a patriot. Mooney's boss, Sloan, explains the business philosophy behind this. An international enterprise which is operating throughout the world should carry out its activities in accordance with strictly economic criteria, regardless of the political views of the country in which it is operating. We are no charity organization. We make profits for our shareholders.
Wir sagten mal, das ist doch ein Witz, nicht? Dass die LKWs hergestellt, womit die Amerikaner bekämpft werden.
We said that must be a joke. Here the trucks are being produced, which are used to fight the Americans. Yes, that's how it was. And still there was no attack. And so we said, sure, after all, the Americans are not so stupid that they destroy their own factory.
Fabrik in Trümmer werfen.
The Americans are not so stupid. The Brandenburg plant is almost completely destroyed by American bombers on August 6, 1944. Years later, however, GM receives $32 million as compensation from the American taxpayer. In 1921, Henry Ford's book, The International Jew, was published in a German translation. Between Henry Ford, the legendary automobile manufacturer, and Adolf Hitler, there existed from an early date a spiritual affinity, anti-Semitism. Ford's book confirmed Hitler in his hatred of Jews and served as a model for his inflammatory book, Mein Kampf.
In Hitler and in the European fascist dictatorships, the owners of the American economy saw a possible solution to their own problems with their own workers' movement and their own unions. Unions, in Henry Ford's view, were the work of the devil.
Hitler's brutal method of dealing with the unions was highly approved of by Ford, who kept armed militias in his factories. Even before Hitler seized power, Ford supported him financially. A portrait of the benefactor hung in the Munich headquarters of the Nazi Party.
As far as Henry Ford is concerned, he was understood as an inspiration for Hitler at that time. He was much more than this. Henry Ford was a kind of god of mass production, or the Pope, I should say. Thousands of people would write to him every day, "You are the greatest hero. You introduced this factory system that has made America so great." Fordismus became the kind of ideology of the German industrial class. They wanted to do it just like Henry Ford showed them how.
Detroit is still the home of Ford. The factories at Piquette, now industrial ruins, once housed the assembly lines from which rolled Ford's famous Tin Lizzy, the first mass-produced cheap automobile. Cologne, 1930. Henry Ford himself lays the foundation stone for his own factory in Germany. At first, business is not good. His cars are too expensive, and many Germans have an aversion to foreign companies. Any average German car owner who buys a foreign car nowadays cannot claim that the reason was its higher quality. For our German cars can now no longer be beaten by foreign ones. In the early 30s, the Ford plants are not working to full capacity. Cologne and Detroit, where Henry's son Edsel has taken charge, seek a solution. In a confidential paper to Edsel, Cologne points out that in Germany a war economy is developing, in which government contracts will become increasingly important. The Americans have no problem with this. They sell their eight-cylinder as a unit for a military jeep. The Ford plants begin to toe the Nazi line. Detroit also goes along with the next concession. The foreign automobile manufacturers are no longer allowed any rubber for tires, nor do they get any foreign currency for import. They have to obtain rubber by means of an exchange deal and have to hand over 25% of the imported rubber to the Nazis for armament purposes. Hitler, friend of the factory, is grateful. Finally, Ford cars from Cologne are permitted to use a stamp of quality German product. Business with the government thrives. In 1938, Ford and Opel are included in the plans of the Wehrmacht, which quickly needs 100,000 trucks, among them heavy traxial trucks and chain-driven vehicles. The Nazis are in a great hurry. In 1938, they want 1,000 trucks at once from Ford. The Cologne plant can't deliver so quickly. The Americans are eager to help out. They apparently have no misgivings. The engines, chassis, and cabins of the trucks delivered by Detroit are put together secretly at night in Cologne and then picked up at daybreak by the Wehrmacht.
Just at the moment when the entire world is focused on Czechoslovakia and the Nazi drive to blackmail Czechoslovakia and move into the Sudetenland, just at that moment, the Nazi military comes to Ford and says, "We need 1,000 trucks now. And, you know, I'm going to ask you, does it seem plausible to you that Ford does not know what these 1,000 trucks are for?
The commission was no secret to Ford. The Nazis had even paid for part of the delivery with precious dollars. But Ford only admitted this decades later. Hitler had already awarded Henry Ford the Order of the German Eagle for services rendered. At the end of 1938, Ford has it pinned to his lapel by the German vice consul in Detroit. Ford now also shows his appreciation for their lucrative business deals. On Hitler's 50th birthday, on the 20th of April 1939, the company transfers 35,000 Reichsmarks to the donation fund AH. During the first years of the war, the production of trucks increases dramatically. There's no record of Henry Ford protesting against this. When Henry Ford hears that the plant in Dearborn is to produce 6,000 engines for the British Royal Air Force, he objects. He only accepts commissions for the defense of the USA, he writes to the London Daily Mail. Yet Ford has no objection to the fact that the French plants under the German occupation regime are working flat out for the Wehrmacht and producing 1,000 trucks a month. The boss of Ford France, Maurice Dollfuss, wants to keep the plant for the Ford family. He resists the influence of the Cologne plant and feels himself directly responsible to the Fords, father and son. Even after America's entry into the war, he sends Edsel Ford reports of the plant's success. As late as June 1942, Edsel Ford thanks Dollfuss for his exemplary work. In Cologne, Ford is only able to produce the supplies for the Wehrmacht with the help of forced labourers. They are put up in their own barracks on the factory grounds. In the later war years, Ford also employs thousands of inmates from concentration camps, who can be hired from the SS for 4 marks a day. Their living and working conditions are brutal. In the factory there were police. There was a Nazi. He wore a kind of badge. He had a swastika here. He was nasty, disgusting. He hated us, the Russians. Russian swine. That's what he always shouted at us. I got beaten up when I went to the night shift. I was all of 2 minutes late. The Nazi threw my girlfriend down the iron staircase. She was unconscious. A punch on the head. That's nothing. To them, we weren't human beings. Now that the USA has entered the war, Ford is a fervent patriot. His factories now produce aircraft, trucks, tanks, and ships for America's victory. By the end of the war, the Ford plant in Cologne has produced 78,000 Wehrmacht trucks and 14,000 chain-driven vehicles. Cologne has been bombed by the Allies since 1942 and is almost entirely destroyed. Until the end of 1944, the Ford plant is spared, and then it's only slightly damaged. In 1965, Ford demands $7 million from the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission. This is reduced to the amount of $500,000 due to the fact that the company had used fraudulent methods in calculating the alleged damages.
His adventures, one attack unconnected in any way with the one that preceded it or the one that will follow it. It is easy for the average citizen to envision the positions of ground armies because of maps like these, which make the positions of the contesting forces quite clear. It is harder to express so graphically the progress of a bombing program. Yet there is a real line in this battle of Germany, not a geographical front, but an industrial one. In the British Isles, there are the Allied air forces, On the European continent, we have Regensburg, Marienburg, Bremen, Oschersleben, Warnemünde, and Kassel. These are the major German fighter assembly plants, and as such are actually the center of Germany's industrial defense line. However, these are only the places where the aircraft is assembled into the finished fighting machine. Component parts for German fighters are made at Anklam, the Weserflugzeugbau works at Bremen, the great Hedderhain propeller works near Frankfurt, the aircraft tire factory at Hanover, the CAM ball bearing plant at Paris, and the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt. Obviously, an assembly plant can't operate if other plants aren't building the parts from which the enemy planes will be assembled. Hulse produced 29% of all German synthetic rubber production and is in fact responsible for 18% of her entire supply of rubber, natural or synthetic.
Small but dangerous minority of industrial managers who perhaps hold out for extra profits or for business as usual.
Standard Oil, later Esso, was the greatest oil colossus in the USA in the 1930s. The company pursued global policies regardless of governments and peoples. Its aim was the creation of monopolies. Standard was part of the Rockefeller Empire. Its head office was in his New York skyscraper. Manager Walter Teagle was said to behave as if he were an emperor. Teagle encountered another giant also aiming to rule the world, IG Farben. And in this German chemical company, there was also a man striving for power, Hermann Schmitz. At first, he was a rival of Standard Oil. IG Farben had developed a method of producing synthetic petrol. Whoever owned the patent would rule the world market in case of an oil shortage. Standard Oil was also obsessed by this fear. It soon came to an agreement with IG Farben. The Germans needed Standard Oil's know-how for the costly production of the synthetic fuel. But Hitler wants war. For strategic reasons, he needs the synthetic petrol, no matter what it costs. In war, his supply of oil would soon be cut off. In 1938, Germany is still importing 80% of its crude oil. They considered building pipelines. They considered building a fleet of tankers. But all these plans were blocked from the beginning because Hitler had ruled that the only solution for Germany was to become self-sufficient.
Richtet sich nur auf die Autarkie.
The wheels for Hitler's war machine need large amounts of rubber. Natural rubber has to be paid for from the limited reserves of foreign currency and will not be available in case of war. Here too, the chemical pioneer IG Farben is able to help. It had developed Buna, a synthetic rubber from lime and coal. In addition to Hitler, there is another interested party, Standard Oil. The company senses a lucrative market, at least in the USA. Standard Oil is not disturbed by the fact that Göring has another market in mind for German petrol and rubber. We knew that we have no fuel, so we built the factories which would give us fuel. We knew that we would be unable to get any rubber, so we built the factories there where they once believed to have monopolies. German science has broken these monopolies, and now, in any case, we are in possession of all those means which we need to vanquish the enemy. Yet Göring's Luftwaffe had forgotten one of these means, the petrol additive lead tetraethyl. Without this, Göring's high-compression aircraft engines would be unable to take off. But Hitler needs a highly efficient air force for his forthcoming invasion of the East. Göring asks the IG Farben bosses to approach the American friends. Standard Oil is the world's leading producer of this additive. The two managers, Walter Teagle in New York and Hermann Schmitz in Berlin, had already some time ago agreed to build two factories for lead tetraethyl in Germany. In June 1938, however, their production is insufficient. A quick direct supply is to remedy the situation. The Standard Oil subsidiary in London immediately delivers $20 million worth of the anti-knock additive to the Nazis, and this despite the immediate danger of war. Hitler is now able to annex the Sudetenland and prepare his attack on Czechoslovakia. Just before Hitler's invasion of Poland, summer 1939, the English once more supply lead tetraethyl to the value of $15 million. With this, the first blitz attacks against England can be launched. The war intensifies Hitler's dependence on oil. The synthetic production in Germany supplies only half of what is needed. Once again, he needs the American friends. Standard Oil owns almost half of the shares in the Romanian oil fields of Ploesti. These are Germany's most important source of crude oil. Distrustful as Hitler is, he represses the Romanians. They are to keep a low profile in the oil company Romano-Americana, in which they are shareholders, and leave the protection of the oil fields to the German Air Force. But Hitler needs more.
Also aus einem Schriftwechsel, der im Militärarchiv in Freiburg liegt.
Well, from correspondence preserved in a military archive in Freiburg, it's clear that the Nazis desperately needed bright stock and that only the USA could supply this. And the supply was absolutely vital for the war and had to take place during the war. And indeed, during the war, bright stock was delivered from the USA, as far as I know, in a quantity sufficient for the entire duration of the war. Bright stock is a high-quality oil product, used, for example, for tank engines. The Third Reich still needs petrol and diesel from the USA. The ships of the American friends now bunker oil in the Caribbean. Most of the tankers fly the Panamanian flag. In the Atlantic, British warships lie in wait, trying to torpedo Hitler's oil supply with a sea blockade.
Die Marine scheint mir ein Sonderfall zu sein.
The Navy seems to me to be a special case, because they made direct deals with the USA and also with the Caribbean states. This is a case where we can prove direct deals. Not in the form of invoices, but in the form of memos, which prove quite clearly that the deals were clinched. But it was also known that these were German-American deals paid for with horrendous sums of foreign money, that the prices rose during the war, and this had the seal of approval from the highest level.
Und dass das auch von höchster Stelle genehmigt war.
For high-quality diesel fuel, the Commander-in-Chief of the Navy is able to demand a quick $500,000 from the limited supply of foreign currency. Hitler wants to rule the Atlantic with his submarines. For this diesel supply, he can also rely on his American friends. Besides Standard Oil, there's also Texaco, whose president is Torkild Riebe, an American of Norwegian descent and a Hitler friend. He also has contacts to the German Secret Service, whose undercover agents pass on glowing reports about him. They certify him as pro-German and as an honest admirer of the Führer. Via Tenerife and other Spanish ports, the tankers of the blockade breakers supply oil for the Germans on the mainland. They even refuel German submarines on the open sea off the Spanish coast. Even after America has entered the war, Standard Oil still delivers petrol to the two Nazi airlines, Condor and Lati. Their planes transport spies, gold and foreign currency to Latin America and bring back precious metals, vital for the war.
On September 22, 1939, following the outbreak of World War II, IG Farben and Standard Oil had agreed that they would maintain a relationship regardless if the United States entered the war.
Den Haag, beginning of September 39, managers from IG Farben and Standard Oil conclude a secret agreement. IG Farben wants to prevent the confiscation of its patents by hostile overseas countries. They seem to be safe in the hands of the US company. When the Buna patent for artificial rubber is handed over, Standard Oil has to agree, at the insistence of the Reich Ministry for Economic Affairs, only to use the patent with the permission of the Germans. Manager Tegel consents to the deal. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor triggers the war in the Pacific. Now the Americans are cut off from their most important rubber supplier, Malaysia. Despite a shortage of rubber in the USA, Standard Oil sticks to its agreement with the Germans. The Buna patent is not to fall into the hands of rivals such as Goodyear. The influential Senator Baruch, assigned by President Roosevelt to investigate the affair, appeals to the nation.
We find that the existing rubber situation to be so dangerous that unless corrective measures are taken immediately, this country will face both a military and a civilian collapse.
At the same time, in the land of oil surplus, petrol has to be rationed. Many Americans, including members of Congress, blame the oil companies who continue to deliver to the Nazis and keep the rubber patents under wraps. Senator Harry Truman, later to become president, responds to public pressure by setting up a Senate committee to investigate the defense situation. He is supported by Thurman Arnold, the cartel specialist in the Ministry of Justice. Standard Oil and its powerful bosses have long been a thorn in his flesh. He had already tried in vain to impose a fine on them of $50,000 for doing business with the enemy. By claiming that they were indispensable for America in wartime, the managers had succeeded in reducing the fine to $1,000. In the Senate hearing, Arnold accuses Standard Oil of holding back the rubber patents and of a continued conspiracy in favor of the Nazis. In a subsequent press conference, Truman speaks of betrayal. As a result of a decision by Congress, the Buna patents are released for America. The mighty Teagle is a broken man and resigns from the management.
Hulse produced 29% of all German synthetic rubber production and is in fact responsible for 18% of her entire supply of rubber, natural or synthetic. At Bochum, there's a great steel plant producing high-grade aviation steel. Herøya, up in Norway, is a great producer of aluminum and magnesium, metals which figure importantly in aircraft production. At Hamm, there are great railroad marshaling yards, having a capacity of 10,000 freight cars a day. Much of the tonnage handled here is closely connected with the manufacture, assembly, maintenance, and repair of enemy aircraft. And so it is all over Germany and occupied Europe. Everywhere there are plants and installations that contribute directly or indirectly to the making of German aircraft. Industrial bastions which must first be ripped apart before the enemy's armies can be destroyed. The smashing blows by the Allied air forces at Hulse, Herøya, Regensburg, Schweinfurt, Hanover and Frankfurt have had the result of piercing the German industrial line to the extent of 37.5% of estimated single-engine fighter production in September of 1943. If this rate of drop continues, there can be only one result: the eventual disappearance of the Luftwaffe as a defensive force. But these attacks have had other far-reaching effects. For instance, in January of 1943, just when the 8th Bomber Command had started daylight attacks against Germany proper, 42% of the German fighter strength was concentrated in Western Europe, 33% of it in Russia, and 25% in the Mediterranean area. After 10 months of American bombers appearing by day over Germany, the figures line up more like this. On the Russian front, 19%. In the Mediterranean area, 12%. And in Western Europe, 69%. Germany thought it was urgent enough to withdraw fighters from two important theaters, all in a vain attempt to save their crumbling industry from the grim, destructive blows of the British-American bomber offensive. That is why the Battle of Germany is being fought. Now we come to the problem: how are the targets selected? And what enormous effort is necessary for the 10 or 15 minutes that our air task forces will be over any given target? The daylight bombing offensive against Germany is the responsibility of the 8th Air Force. Under the 8th Air Force are the 8th Bomber Command, the 8th Fighter Command, and the 8th Air Service Command, all of whom contribute to every bombing mission. But it is the Bomber Command which is charged with the actual destruction of the selected targets. The Bomber Command, with which this picture is primarily concerned, is divided into three divisions. Each division has a number of combat wings. Each combat wing, in turn, has three groups. This is the chain of command.
In 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. He appointed Schacht as head of the Reichsbank and Nazi representative at the BIS. Hitler said of Schacht,
"It was his consummate skill at swindling other people which made him indispensable at the time. After all, seeing that the whole gang of financiers is a bunch of crooks, what possible point was there in being scrupulously honest with them? Before each meeting of the International Bank at Basel, half the world was anxious to know whether Schacht would attend or not. It was only after the assurance that he would be there that the Jew bankers of the entire world packed their bags and prepared to attend. In spite of his ability, I could never trust Schacht, for I had often seen how his face lit up when he succeeded in swindling someone out of a 100-mark note."
Schacht, of course, was a complicated fellow. He was sometimes being a central banker, sometimes being a Nazi, sometimes being an anti-Nazi. If you read his work, he's all over the place.
It was Schacht's job to arrange finance for the building of the Third Reich. The BIS channeled investments from the Allied powers into Germany for the expansion of her economy. Although after 1933 there were no new investments, existing investments were renewed annually and paid into Hitler's Reich. By 1939, 294 million gold Swiss francs had been channeled into the German economy. Schacht's economic priority became the rearmament of Germany. Through the BIS, the Allies had been investing in an economy gearing itself for war, including one of the most important, Montagu Norman, governor of the Bank of England. Norman was also a close personal friend of Hjalmar Schacht.
Both used instinct, as did my father.
In America, the danger of the growing BIS was realized by Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau. He shared with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt a suspicion of the banking community.
There was a considerable feeling against Wall Street at that time on the part of the new Democratic Party, which formed itself around Roosevelt. It was the first time in some years that the Secretary of the Treasury had not been a banker. Morgenthau was loyal to the president to an nth degree, and they had a remarkably close personal relationship. But he didn't understand the intricacies of international finance, foreign exchange. The principal concern of everybody was getting out of the Depression. The international fear of a war coming in Europe was there in some people, but it was not a predominant feeling in political circles. But Morgenthau was always watching American trade with Germany.
Even though he was a political person, I believe in many cases his principles came first. As far as Nazi Germany was concerned, nothing moved him more deeply than his hatred of Nazi Germany because of what it stood for. Morgenthau felt that we shouldn't cooperate in any way with a country of that kind. But I don't think this ever occurred to people who dealt with them in terms of their international financial relations.
Gefallen. Ein Volk hat zueinander gefunden.
When the Nazis annexed Austria in the spring of 1938, Morgenthau's fears that the BIS could be used as a tool of imperialism proved right. One of Germany's first acts was to demand that the gold held in Austria's name at the BIS be transferred to the vaults of Hitler's Reichsbank. The BIS, as servant of its central banks, dutifully transferred 22 tons of gold.
They were interested in maximizing the profits of their commercial banks, carrying out financial policies and economic policies of their countries. They probably didn't think there was in their province to be guided in any way by the nature of the country that they were dealing with.
On March 16, 1939, Montague Norman was still espousing the virtues of the BIS.
The BIS, whose monthly meetings in Switzerland provide invaluable opportunities of contact, started in the difficult times of 1930, but already has fully shown its worth and will surely prove it in the future.
As he spoke, Hitler's troops were occupying Czechoslovakia. Again, the Nazis demanded Czechoslovakia's gold, just as they had done with Austria's. But this time there was a problem. Much of Czechoslovakia's gold had been shipped to a safe haven, the Bank of England. Unfortunately, some of it was in a BIS account at the bank.
The Nazis wanted to take over the Czech gold to bolster their foreign income. I was told the governor and his senior colleagues were head up at pistol point and said, if you don't authorize this transshipment of the gold, you've had it.
The directors of Czechoslovakia's National Bank were ordered to contact the BIS and demand that their BIS gold be transferred to the Reichsbank. Because the gold was in England, the BIS called Britain's central bank and informed Montague Norman at the Bank of England of the Czech instruction. Like the BIS, Norman saw no way of stopping the transfer. But by the rules of the BIS, Montague Norman had the power to delay the transfer if he did so by the end of the day when all banking transactions had to be completed. But Norman took no action, and £6 million worth of gold was credited to the Reichsbank. When the Bank of England's actions became known, they caused uproar in the Houses of Parliament.
The Bank of England, after what has happened, may no longer be looked upon as the safest place in the world, and the phrase, safe as the Bank of England, may no longer apply.
The Bank for International Settlements is the bank which sanctions the most notorious outrage of this generation, the rape of Czechoslovakia.
In Washington, Morgenthau and his team tried to piece together the Czech gold affair.
The Treasury had a lot of information and contacts coming in from these five or six top Treasury people in the embassies. The one in London, whose name was Butterworth, knew everybody in the banking community in London and knew his business, and his reports were important.
Well, you've read Butterworth's cable on Czech gold. When you boil it all down, this is what I get out of it. That almost £6 million of BIS gold was transferred.
It's of interest to us because a year ago we took the position that might happen and we didn't want to deal with the BIS.
Well, it's a dirty business, whichever way you look at it.
With the invasion of Poland, war in Europe broke out. When Holland and then Belgium fell, the Reichsbank looted their gold, giving Hitler more money for more weapons, for more war. that gold found its way to the BIS. But even while British and French soldiers were being driven back to Dunkirk, the Bank of England's position did not change on the BIS. Its constitution gave it diplomatic immunity.
La désignation des ports devra tenir compte des ports d'attache du temps de paix.
In June 1940, the citizens of Paris learned of their country's defeat.
When Paris fell in 1940, I decided that it was time to get out of Basel. Either the war would be short and the Germans would win, in which case I wouldn't want to be there, or the war would be long, and in which case I wouldn't want to be there. And my wife was pregnant, and so we went to one doctor, an older man. He said, don't travel. So we went to his nephew, a younger obstetrician. He said, travel. So as is often the case, if you get two conflicting opinions, you take the one you want.
McKittrick officially suspended board meetings for the duration of the war. He and the economic advisor of the bank went to live at Rougemont, 100 miles from Basel.
A friend of his owned the castle, and McKittrick had permission to use it. I went and counted the number of beds in the servants' wing, and there were 22. And we had a staff of six plus one chauffeur.
During the war, enemy nationals were ordered not to fraternize, but at the BIS, old friendships died hard.
A technical show was made of keeping the Allies on one side and the Germans on the other side, but of course it never worked out. They just sort of mixed up and walked across the room and said, now, Hans, how did you get on when you were doing and had your new baby come and all these things? And, you know, you wouldn't have known a war was on.
Even after America's entry into the war in December 1941, McKittrick's presidency of the bank went unchallenged by Nazi officials. More disturbingly, reports were coming through to Washington that Montague Norman and his good friend Hjalmar Schacht, now Reichsminister without portfolio, were making contact about a separate peace. On July 25, 1942, Roosevelt cabled Churchill.
I think the Prime Minister should know that from a Madrid source, word is being sent that Montague Norman is establishing contacts with Schacht with regard to peace feelers.
Winston Churchill to Eden, 26 July.
Foreign Secretary, I cannot believe such a thing, that either you should see him or I.
Eden to Churchill, 29th July.
Prime Minister, I have seen Montague Norman, who states emphatically that he has had no communication of any kind with Schacht for more than a year.
Churchill to Eden, 31st July.
Foreign Secretary, we have been at war for over 2¾ years. Can he extend his assurance to cover the whole period?
No assurance to Churchill appears in the file. Nevertheless, Eden cabled Washington, insisting that no contact had taken place between Schacht and Norman during the war. Without documentation, it isn't possible to know definitely whether they were in touch. Meanwhile, in public, McKittrick went through the facade of addressing the annual meetings of the BIS in an empty boardroom, to prove that the BIS board was not sitting in time of war. But away from the public gaze, McKittrick maintained contact with the board members, and Nazi, Italian, Japanese, and British staff of the BIS continued to meet and do business. Throughout the war, Germany was drawing dividends on its investments in the bank, including those of some of the countries it had conquered.
It has been said that foreign exchange control is like sex. It's a very difficult thing to enforce. And I suppose you could go to another level and say that where an obvious profit exists anywhere, it's very difficult to prevent people from taking advantage of it. There's a drive beneath for sex, for profit.
It had been put to them that the bank, for the good of the world, and remember it was open which side would win. The bank would be needed in the post-war world, and they had to behave like human beings to ensure this. I mean, the British staff and the German staff went off on these hikes. The secretaries were there, of course, and it was perfectly amicable. They didn't make a big show of going a bunch of Germans here and a bunch of British there. They intermingled, really, like normal human beings.
The staff of the BIS also enjoyed travel privileges, courtesy of the Axis powers. In 1942, BIS President Thomas McKittrick set off for the United States. Astonishingly, he returned in May 1943 via Rome with the permission of the fascist authorities, despite the fact that Italy was at war with his native America.
My father went up to Sweden, I think that was about 43. He went through Germany, and of course he always saw Mr. Poole, the Reichsbank. He asked Poole to let him go to England, and Poole said, oh, yes, do go to England. In fact, it would be very good for the BIS if you did. Poole was definitely for keeping relations with the central banks as intact as possible. He certainly sent messages to Norman through my father, saying, I hope you're all right and that you haven't been bombed out or something like that.
American intelligence also later indicated that Poole met with McKittrick to discuss attitudes in America towards Germany, and that McKittrick even traveled to Germany in 1943. The apparent closeness of BIS's relationship with the Axis powers was viewed with alarm by a growing team of U.S. Treasury investigators.
When I went to work there in the fall of 42, there may have been 14, 20 lawyers and about 100 investigators and maybe 100 auxiliary personnel. And it ended up in a very large outfit of 2,000 or 3,000 people. We were, I guess, very idealistic people. We felt that when young men and women were risking their lives and being killed in the mud in Italy, they deserved better from the folks at home and from their government.
The British Treasury took a different view on the BIS. The Bank of England was continuing to receive interest from the Reichsbank on pre-war investments in Germany through the BIS. Now the Nazis had the looted gold from occupied Europe to help make the payments. In the summer of 1944, Edward Playfair defended Britain's position.
Nothing has happened to make us change our views, which are wholly different from those of the United States Treasury. It seems to me important that we should not just sit back and appear to accept their view as the right one. I saw it estimated that Axis Europe was paying around £760,000 a year in interest to the BIS and getting one-third of it back as dividends. We get the rest.
By 1944, the U.S. Treasury had a massive dossier detailing the collaborative activities of the BIS. And when the Norwegian government in exile made a formal protest about the BIS's activities, Morgenthau was ready to make his move.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrive for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. They will work in the seclusion of this White Mountains resort.
The Norwegians had a good deal of information, and it was they who introduced the resolution at the Bretton Woods Conference that the BIS should be shut down as soon as possible. Morgenthau was impressed with this. He had talked to the Norwegians, and he was impressed and convinced that this was a desirable resolution.
But not all delegates at Bretton Woods were so convinced. Representing the view of the Bank of England and British Treasury, economist Maynard Keynes went to see Morgenthau and in an off-the-record meeting argued that the BIS should not be closed down, since the bank would be needed for post-war reconstruction. While the debate over the BIS raged at Bretton Woods, the tide of war had turned against the Nazis. Allied troops had invaded Northern Europe. Within 11 weeks, they had taken Paris. Harsh treatment was meted out to the Parisians who had collaborated with the enemy. But when Morgenthau sent a treasury agent to Paris with the liberating forces, he discovered unpleasant truths about the extent of the collaboration. In December 1944, a report arrived on his desk about the activities of the Paris branch of the Chase, one of the biggest banks in America.
The Chase Paris showed itself most anxious to please the German authorities in every possible way. For example, the Chase zealously maintained the account of the German embassy in Paris, as every little thing helps. The whole objective of the Chase policy and operation was to maintain the position of the bank at any cost. I recommend that this investigation should be pressed urgently and additional personnel be sent to Paris ASAP.
In New York, Treasury agent Marjorie Farber was assigned to investigate the Chase Bank.
It had been requested by the Treasury that Chase make available all its correspondence with Paris, and I was sent there to look at it. There had been some rumors about the Chase Bank cooperating with the German industry, so perhaps that was the reason why, but anyway, that was what I was supposed to look into, whether there was anything behind it or not.
In the course of her investigations, Marjorie Farber discovered a worrying truth. In 1941, decrees were announced in France restricting the freedom of Jews. The Chase Paris took a controversial measure.
They jumped the gun. They broached the question, well, if that's the case, perhaps we shouldn't let the depositors who are Jewish, who deposit in Paris, we shouldn't let them take their money out either.
These measures taken against Jews by the Chase Paris occurred while America was at peace with Germany. A later report contextualized the actions of the Chase Paris, saying that the Chase had received a notice of the freezing of Jewish assets and believed the freeze was legally binding. The same report also confirmed that a leading member of staff at the Chase Paris had made the most of his opportunities of being nice to the German officials. U.S. Treasury investigations also cited other banks in France as having cooperated with the Nazis.
One of the banks, I don't remember whether it was Westminster or Barclays, they asked the administrator appointed by the German government whether they should keep the Jewish employees. Maybe they should throw them out or get rid of them one way or another. And his answer was, I really don't care. He said, go by French regulations. I have none. Now, they didn't have to ask that, obviously. The intention was certainly to make a good impression.
In fact, a report by Farber names both Westminster and Barclays employees, acting beyond the control of their London offices, as having volunteered to the Germans that they had Jewish staff. But there is no mention in the report that they took action against Jewish assets as early as the chase.
The banks in France had an interest in developing business with the Nazis. It was really a trade-off. They would try to provide services to the Nazis by reason of providing information. They would seek favor with them, and they would receive deposits.
Seven French banks and Barclays are being sued for any Jewish assets retained. Only Barclays are not filing to dismiss the action and are committed to returning all assets traced. There were even suspicions that the Nazis were using the BIS to convert the looted possessions of camp victims into Swiss francs.
I don't think we knew what specifically the BIS was doing, but even without full proof, the U.S. Treasury was convinced that the BIS was assisting the Germans in this process, even down to looting the Holocaust victims, the teeth and gold watches and whatnot.
American intelligence reports show that the BIS permitted transfers of Nazi gold as late as April 1945. Though no evidence exists that the BIS knew the source of the gold or whether it was concentration camp loot, proof that two BIS directors handled the spoils of the Holocaust was to emerge. In March 1945, Morgenthau sent an investigator to Basel to question McKittrick.
I thought you would be interested in the attached memorandum of my conversation with McKittrick in Switzerland. I was surprised that a voluntary recital intended as a defense of the BIS could be such an indictment of that institution. I asked McKittrick why, in his opinion, the Germans had been willing to allow the BIS to run in the manner which he had described. McKittrick's explanation was as follows. There's a little group in Germany who do not share the Nazi point of view, but who are so important to the Nazis and the management of German finances that they would continue to hold important positions. I asked McKittrick, would he name any of this little group? The only person he named was Poole.
Will you state your full name?
Emil Johann Rudolf Poole.
The following year, BIS Director and Reichsbank Vice President Emil Poole was tried and convicted of crimes against humanity for his involvement in laundering the gold of murdered Jews from the concentration and death camps.
Killing firsthand was not his thing. He was tried primarily for two activities. One was handling the deposit of some of the grisly byproducts of the concentration camps, gold teeth, gold watches, gold pens, gold spectacle cases taken from newly created corpses in the concentration camps. The Reichsbank had vaults full of this stuff, small mountains, really. The second activity was making funds readily available to the SS for concentration camp building. And Poole, in order to make sure that the state wasn't investing its money foolishly, toured the concentration camps and made sure that they were doing what they were supposed to do.
Also tried and convicted was BIS Director and Reichsbank President Walter Funk.
The head of the Reichsbank would not know that. Would you know about the 1,000 wagons of textiles that this SS man said had been shipped, or warehousing composed of the clothing of dead Jews who'd been exterminated?
In the course of the trials, some other intriguing evidence came to light.
Well, I can recall a Dresdner Bank document, which I thought was interesting, which listed American bankers favorable to the German cause. I think that was practically the heading of the document. It was a who's who of American bankers.
And the Chase was definitely on that list.
Oh, yes, the Chase was on the list. That was one of the things that caught my eye.
As the war drew to a close, Morgenthau had begun to receive reports on Nazi plans for a resurrection of Germany after her defeat, financed by investments in America and other neutral countries. His suspicions about Germany reinforced, he completed a plan which was to remain his notorious footnote in history.
Position of Morgenthau and White were that you shouldn't allow Germany to be reindustrialized. Germany should become a cabbage patch. You could have small shops with, and grow crops, but never become an industrial power again.
Morgenthau's plan was rejected, and in April 1945, he lost his greatest protector. After the death of President Roosevelt, Morgenthau resigned from public office, and his investigations into the banks and their collaboration with the Nazis were wound down. No further action was taken against the Chase, Barclays, or Westminster banks, and in Basel, the BIS left their old headquarters behind them, but continue to this day to do business as usual.
The important thing was to try and arrange for a decent post-war period. I mean, that's what they all saw, whichever side they were on. If you have one institution in Europe, well, you want it to stay working, be important, and really help in the post-war period, and that's what the BIS did.
According to the testimony, you said we have fallen into the hands of criminals. How could
its architect, Hjalmar Schacht, had been imprisoned by the Nazis for the last months of the war. Though acquitted at Nuremberg, in 1947, a German court sentenced him to 8 years hard labor for war crimes.
Hitler und seine Genossen.
Hitler, you know, is dead.
On appeal in 1948, he was acquitted of all charges and set up his own bank. His old friend, Montague Norman, became Lord Norman. He went down in history as the longest-serving governor of the Bank of England. McKittrick resigned from the BIS at the end of the war and returned to America to become vice president of the Chase Bank. Emil Puhl was released after serving just 4 years and 7 months in prison. And in 1954, he applied for a visa to America. He gave his visa reference as the Chase Bank. The American Consulate General wrote, commenting on his war crimes record,
"It should be noted that the Consulate General has, in the course of its examination, found no other grounds which would prevent Mr. Poole from receiving a non-immigrant visa. Mr. Poole is one of the outstanding bankers in Germany and wishes to proceed to the United States on the invitation of several well-known American bankers to participate in discussions of some importance."
Documents that might show whether Poole entered the United States remain classified.
They were going to be on the right side no matter what happened. Banking is banking. And that these fellows were interested in having a nice, peaceful relationship. German, British, didn't matter to them. A nice, peaceful relationship with everybody making money.
In 2001, two German Holocaust survivors sued the US government and then-President George Bush's family for $40 billion in compensation. They claimed that the Bush political dynasty had financially benefited from Auschwitz slave labor during World War II, and that it was this money that had established their family fortune and political empire. The Holocaust survivors were prompted to raise the case by evidence in declassified files found in the U.S. National Archives. They revealed that late Senator Prescott Bush, father to the 41st President George H.W. Bush and grandfather of the 43rd President George W. Bush, was involved with the men who funded the Nazi Party into government, raising the problematic question, did the Bush family help get Hitler into power? With senators, governors, and two US presidents emerging from this single family in just three generations, the Bush family are widely considered to be the most successful political dynasty in American history. It was founded by Prescott Bush, whose career took off after marrying Dorothy Walker in 1921. Her father made Bush a managing director and shareholder of the newly formed Union Banking Corporation, also known as UBC. UBC was set up to provide a U.S. financial base for Germany's most powerful industrial family, the Tysons. The Tyson family owned the largest steel and coal company in Germany. The Tyson business empire was inherited by Fritz Tyson, who donated heavily to the Nazi Party, became a member in 1931, and even bought the Nazi headquarters, Barlow Palace, for Hitler. His support allowed the Nazis to consolidate power and step straight into government. Fritz Tyson was also Prescott Bush's boss. By the late 1930s, Bush's bank, UBC, had bought and shipped millions of dollars of gold, fuel, steel, coal, and US Treasury bonds to Germany, directly financing Hitler and his build-up to war. As Tyson's Steel Corporation grew rich by Hitler's efforts to re-equip Germany's army, Prescott Bush took on more responsibility and became a director and shareholder for a number of Tyson's shell companies. The most notorious of Tyson's companies managed by UBC was the Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, otherwise known as CSSC. CSSC was located on the German-Polish border and used Nazi slave labor from Auschwitz. Documents from the US National Archives show that UBC's involvement with CSSC was not limited to holding shares for the company, and it is likely that the American directors, including Prescott Bush, may have also financially invested in the corporation. A New York Times article published at the time revealed that anonymous American interests held one-third of CSSC. The German businessman who owned the other two-thirds of CSSC also owned part of the chemical company that developed and knowingly sold the poison that gassed millions to death during the Holocaust. American investments in Nazi Germany were curtailed during World War II. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, America entered the war, making it illegal for companies to engage in profitable business transactions with the Axis powers. Despite this, UBC continued to secretly trade, but their continuous gold purchases raised suspicions that the bank was in fact just a nest egg for Nazi investors. In 1942, the alien property custodian seized UBC assets, as well as the Silesian American Company, another one of Prescott Bush's ventures. A report issued by the Office of Alien Property Custodian concluded that the seized properties were operated by the German government and undoubtedly of considerable assistance to its war effort. It is still disputed whether or not Prescott Bush ever did more than own these companies on paper. Nevertheless, neither Bush nor his colleagues were ever prosecuted for their role in Hitler's rise to power, Germany's rearming, or their exploitation of Holocaust victims. In 1938, Fritz Tyson himself ended his financial support for Hitler and fled to Switzerland, but he was found and arrested in 1941, ironically spending the remainder of the war in a concentration camp. It is reported, but not verified, that when Tyson died a few years after the war, his US assets were liquidated, allowing Bush to cash in his share of UBC, worth $1.5 million. Whilst the exact details of Prescott Bush's involvement with Nazi Germany have been lost to history, in 2003 the Anti-Defamation League stated that rumors about the alleged Nazi ties of the late Prescott Bush are untenable and politically motivated. Prescott Bush was neither a Nazi nor a Nazi sympathizer. Meanwhile, former US attorney John Loftus emphasizes that Prescott Bush was just involved in the same thing as many other American and British businessmen at the time. The 2001 legal case against the Bush family was dismissed on the grounds that a government cannot be held liable. Nevertheless, the question of the Bush family's role during World War II persists.
As you and I both know, the profile that the Rothschilds have taken in banking have also opened themselves up to a great deal of criticism. And it seems to me that the real people who control those fortunes aren't even the people whose name is on the banner out front of the building.
I think that they are very much in control. And I think that the fact that they are, most of them are private corporations, even the Rockefellers, because they are from the Sephardic elite. I mean, they claim to be Christians, but in actual fact, they're claimed, I mean, Nelson Rockefeller and others, people like that, they are part of the Sephardic Jewish elite. And therefore, historically, you'll find now, say, Jacob Schiff, Karenina Schiff is married to Al Gore's son, you know, a daughter rather. So the family, it is a dynasty that continues from generation to generation historically, and the biblical account and the Quranic account point out that this group are against the Torah and against God's commandments, but they derive enormous power through the creation and control of money.
Well, what you've just pointed out is something important, because we've done some work on what we call and what the Encyclopedia Judaica calls crypto-Judaism, and you just pointed out that the Rockefellers and others have been, where they were not able to be upfront about their Jewish roots, they used subterfuge, and they used actual fraud to set themselves up as Christians, wolves in sheep's clothing here.
And so
we look at the Muranos. We did a study on this on the French Connection. We also look at the Dolmets in Turkey.
Yes.
We've looked at throughout history where even including some of the leadership of the Nazi Party being Jewish, and including the Jews in charge of communism in Russia.
Oh yes.
So we've got crypto Judaism across the time and history of these people. And do we have it in large measure in America today?
Indeed. Well, look, what was also interesting is I have been following this particular line of inquiry. I have a copy of the Jewish Chronicle in front of me. Now, the Jewish Chronicle is one of the most eminent and respected journals. And December the 6th, 1996, there's a headline, Who Were Hitler's Jewish Soldiers? There were about 169 senior officers who were either entirely Jewish or half Jewish, including the head of the Luftwaffe, Field Marshal Erhard Milch, was Jewish. Now, including Wilberg, the designer of Blitzkrieg, and there's a whole bunch of them in the Daily Telegraph, again, another respected universe. Basically, the fatherland honor. You have Helmut Wilberg, the architect in the concept of Blitzkrieg, Edgar Jacobson, and also Helmut Schmidt, who became the head of the government in Germany after World War II. So Helmut Schmidt was half Jewish. So but these are the people who didn't do anything to try and liberate the people from the concentration camps. They were part of the system.
Well, of course, the goal, according to both Myron Fagan's work as well as more importantly Benjamin Friedman, being a first person account, was to get an exodus of Jews to repopulate the Holy Land so that they could get their 6 million number. And of course, we could talk at another show about them wanting to bring in their new Messiah.
But if I can just, before you go on from that, it's a very, very important point.
Uh-huh.
What the important thing is that the ones who were in the concentration camp, and there was a Holocaust, there's no doubt about that. Periodically through history, you find this has happened. But if you read the Torah or the Bible, you see that God sent them to be an excoriation and a hissing and a booing to the lands that he'd sent them, and they were not to return to Palestine until the Messiah came. But the ones who were exterminated, and whether the figure is 1.4 million or 6 million, the point was that they were the ones who wanted to uphold the traditions of the Torah and wanted basically to re-implement the Sharia of Moses, which Muslims would have accepted. But it's a secular belonging of Israel today, and the ones who were exterminated were the ones who were believers in God, basically.
So true Torah Jews were selected out.
Yes, that's right. They didn't want people with consciences, like the Natura Carta, who, of course, are very brave people. They are critical and openly oppose the State of Israel because it is contrary to what God ordered them to do.
Well, I've been working with Rabbi Weiss over in New York.
Yeah, excellent people. Excellent.
Yes, they are.
If you mentioned something a little earlier about J.P. Morgan. Now we're jumping around a little bit, but I think we're entitled to be in this stage just to J.P. Morgan, and we come to we had World War One, and what's interesting that there's a very famous economist called Silvio Gesell. And he predicted, you're on the continent, but not too far away from where he was, but he wrote an article in the German newspaper Zeitung am Mittag, a German language newspaper. When they were signing the armistice in 1918, he predicted World War II would occur within less than 25 years, and he said, exactly, and within the time frame, it was proven to be correct. What's interesting about J.P. Morgan and the links between the Bush family, I have here an article that shows that the main financiers of Hitler was Prescott Bush, and George Bush's other grandfather, you know, the Herbert Walker,
and also the Harriman fortune,
the Harrimans, yeah, Benny Harriman and Avril Harriman, etc. And these were, of course, the main people behind the Bush, behind the Hitler project. Now, the intriguing thing is that with the power of the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, because the Bank of England, the governor of the Bank of England from the 20s, early 20s onward, the longest serving governor was Montague Norman. Now, he put us back on the gold standard in 1928, and Winston Churchill was going to hang him for treason for putting us on the gold standard. And then later, of course, Hilmar Schacht went from New York, from the J.P. Morgan Bank, to become Hitler's banker. And he understood, of course, the how to solve the problem of inflation, because the banks create inflation. So this is a link between America and the Hitler project, and the Bush family being the main, two of the main financiers of that project.
So George Bush's patron saint is that of Hitler and his crew.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
I'm afraid so. That the article I have from the in the Guardian, I did a piece, three articles for the Gulf Today, and it was entitled "When Bush Comes to Shove," and that was published in there. But the Guardian then, and the British Guardian, which is a most respected newspaper, then published exactly the article, "How Bush's Grandfathers Helped Hitler's Rise to Power," and that is the Guardian, which is one of the most prestigious papers. And there's a picture of Prescott Bush, who a friend of mine, I have three Jewish friends who converted to Islam, by the way, and one of them said, yes, we know of the Ashkenazim links between the Bush family, so what you were telling me earlier is very intriguing about the Bush connection. I'm very,
well,
very
Solomon,
interested.
There was an actual George Bush that was Jewish that came over with the New Bohemians.
Right.
There was also another Solomon Bush. Now, Solomon Bush particularly is interesting because he came over with a pocket full of cash,
right,
to set up one of four Masonic lodges at the behest of Weishaupt. And of course, Weishaupt was set up the umbrella organization of the Illuminati.
Yes, of course.
Which basically is just a camp for you know, tricking the wealthy Jewish financiers into this conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the conspiracy, of course, you know, when you start looking at it, not all the Jewish community under this Sabbatian movement was part of this stuff. And what they did was they were very brilliant. They always set up conflicting organizations that they controlled at both sides of.
Yes, exactly.
So that if you thought you were fighting Sabbatianism as a Jew, you were actually in a camp that was working with them. And it's just astonishing.
Well, I think if you go back to the famous, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan, the great American, he was the head of both the Scottish Rite and the new southern jurisdiction of Masonry, Albert Pike.
That's right.
Now, Albert Pike, of course, he was the head of both conflicting groups, and this is precisely what you just said is correct. You manipulate both because neither of them know, but there is one controlling element, and this is genius at work.
No, it is genius, but it's genius in its simplicity.
Yeah.
And what
Hulz produced 29% of all German synthetic rubber production and is in fact responsible for 18% of her entire supply of rubber, natural or synthetic. At Bochum, there's a great steel plant producing high-grade aviation steel. Herøya, up in Norway, is a great producer of aluminum and magnesium, metals which figure importantly in aircraft production. At Hamm, there are great railroad marshalling yards, having a capacity of 10,000 freight cars a day. Much of the tonnage handled here is closely connected with the manufacture, assembly, maintenance, and repair of enemy aircraft. And so it is all over Germany and occupied Europe. Everywhere there are plants and installations that contribute directly or indirectly to the making of German aircraft. Industrial bastions which must first be ripped apart before the enemy's armies can be destroyed. The smashing blows by the Allied air forces at Hulz, Herøya, Regensburg, Schweinfurt, Hanover and Frankfurt have had the result of piercing the German industrial line to the extent of 37.5% of estimated single-engine fighter production in September of 1943. If this rate of drop continues, there can be only one result: the eventual disappearance of the Luftwaffe as a defensive force. But these attacks have had other far-reaching effects. For instance, in January of 1943, just when the 8th Bomber Command had started daylight attacks against Germany proper, 42% of the German fighter strength was concentrated in Western Europe, 33% of it in Russia, and 25% in the Mediterranean area. After 10 months of American bombers appearing by day over Germany, the figures line up more like this. On the Russian front, 19%. In the Mediterranean area, 12%. And in Western Europe, 69%. Germany thought it was urgent enough to withdraw fighters from two important theaters, all in a vain attempt to save their crumbling industry from the grim, destructive blows of the British-American bomber offensive. That is why the Battle of Germany is being fought. Now we come to the problem: how are the targets selected? And what enormous effort is necessary for the 10 or 15 minutes that our air task forces will be over any given target? The daylight bombing offensive against Germany is the responsibility of the 8th Air Force. Under the 8th Air Force are the 8th Bomber Command, the 8th Fighter Command, and the 8th Air Service Command, all of whom contribute to every bombing mission. But it is the Bomber Command which is charged with the actual destruction of the selected targets. The Bomber Command, with which this picture is primarily concerned, is divided into three divisions. Each division has a number of combat wings. Each combat wing, in turn, has three groups. This is the chain of command.